Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Deja vu at the border as Turkey opens the gates to Europe to refugees. And Greece is on the front line. We talk to the minister in charge. Then, the wars that have fueled this migrant crisis, Syria and Afghanistan. Perspective on U.S. foreign policy from experts Vali Nasser and The New Yorker's Susan Glasser. And
we're not talking about a moral failing. We're not talking about a crime. We're talking about a disease.
A bracingly frank interview on the pain and price of addiction from a New York State senator with personal experience.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. History is repeating itself at Europe's border as migrants are desperately trying to make their way from Turkey into Greece. Now, this all stems from Syria, where airstrikes have caused even more civilians to flee their country and cross into Turkey. The country says it's unable to handle this influx, and so it's no longer stopping migrants crossing into the European Union. But now, President Erdogan says there will be a ceasefire in northern Syria set to go into effect at midnight local time. The result of all of this, though, is a migrant crisis, leaving shocking violence on the edge of the European continent, as our Jomana Karadze reports now.
We don't know her name. She's too distraught to speak. But you really don't need words to explain this gut-wrenching grief. Those with her tell us her husband was killed at the border. Turkey says Greek border guards opened fire on refugees and migrants gathered at its border on Wednesday, killing one and injuring five others. The Greek government denies using live ammunition and calls it fake news fabricated by Turkey. But it's not just the Turkish government making these accusations.
We're not allowed past this police line, but the situation seems chaotic. We've seen several ambulances coming in and out.
This man made it out of the area where thousands are gathered by the border fence. He says they were protesting peacefully. They said, go away. Then they shot at us, he says. The Greek government is openly firing live ammunition, an accusation Greece categorically denies. We spoke with a Syrian refugee who also says he witnessed the incident.
He saw one person, he says, hit in the chest by a tear gas canister. Hayır Sas, we're also hearing pops of... It's unclear what's being fired and who's firing what.
At the local hospital where the injured were taken, Turkish health officials are keen to show us a photo of a bullet they claim was removed from one of the wounded.
Because the Greek side is saying they didn't use live ammunition, they did not use bullets.
They removed it.
30-year-old Zashar Omar, a Pakistani laborer, says he saw people gathered at the border fence. He thought that they might be opening the gate to enter Greece, so he ran up. This mobile phone footage shows Omar being carried away moments after he was shot in the leg. All he wanted, he says, was a better life.
Pakistan not working. No business, no job.
Back at the border, a steady stream of new arrivals, undeterred by the news of violence and Europe's determination to keep them out. Some say they know Turkey's using them as leverage, trying to get more support from Europe. People so desperate for a different life that they're willing to risk everything for this uncertainty. Jumana Karadze, CNN, on the Turkish-Greek border.
Joining me now is the Greek government's point person for this crisis, State Minister George Gerapetridis. He's joining us right now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation, Christiane. It's a great honor.
Well, this is quite disturbing, the report we heard from Jomana there, our correspondent at the border. And she has shown us pictures of people who say they have been shot by Greek border guards, and a Turkish doctor showing a picture of a bullet that was extracted from a leg. I mean, it looked pretty persuasive. What can you tell us about the orders that your forces at the border are given?
What I have to say, first of all, is that there has been no excessive violence whatsoever. There has been no bullets in the on the spot. And the Greek army and the Greek police forces have used any sort of proportionate measures in order to try and keep all those people away from the Greek borders. What I have to indicate here is, first, that there has been an extreme propaganda coming from the Turkish officials. I have to recall, and there is a video to this effect that has been demonstrated to the Council of Ministers yesterday, according to which all people who have been gathered to the Greek borders, they have been accompanied by the Turkish authorities. There were messages indicating that the borders are open. The President Erdogan himself has stated that everybody should go to the borders, and he threatened Europe with an influx of immigrants and refugees. Further, Christian, I have to say that from those who have illegally entered the Greek borders, only 4% come from Syria. I repeat, only 4% come from Syria. So it's obvious that this has nothing to do with the crisis in Syria. The majority of people come from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, they are gathered there directly by the Turkish authorities. They speak Turkish very fluently, which means that they've been in the country for a long time. And to tell you the truth, it is the firm conviction of the Greek government and of the European Union after the council yesterday that here we have an inhumane instrumentalization of people for the benefit of geopolitical and diplomatic stating.
All right. So now let me just break that down a little bit. As you know, well, first and foremost, I want to ask you your categorical statement. Are there any orders to use live fire? Is any live fire provided to your forces? Any tear gas as well? But first, live fire.
All measures taken exclude bullets, so everything is fully legitimate. I cannot reflect on the use of specific measures to actually respond to a hybrid attack, because here we have a hybrid attack to the borders. The Greek government has stated in a most categorical way that it is fully illegal to enter the Greek and European borders. We have only used symmetrical and proportionate force in order to react. So no real weaponry. On the contrary, as you probably know, there has been gas firing from the Turkish side. And today, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Turkey has stated that 1,000 people of the special forces of the Turkish army will be gathering to the Greek-Turkish borders. So it's not an escalation that comes from Greece, obviously. We are there in order to protect our sovereign rights and the right of the European Union to have integral borders. There has been no victims out of this. And I have to say that has been a great practice of self-determination on the part of the Greek army and self-restraint, because you can imagine today we have about 10 to 15,000 people just outside Kastanyes, which is the closest part to the Turkish borders. They have made camps over there in order to exercise pressure. More people are accumulated on the borderline. No excessive violence has been used.
Okay, so let me ask you this. You say that you in Europe have determined that this is a deliberate methodology by the Turkish government to leverage these poor people in order for Europe to support Turkey's military operation, but also its humanitarian intervention and its needs. As you very well know, of all the countries who've been housing refugees from Syria and, you know, across the world, is Turkey, with more than 4 million refugees. So, you know, I guess the question is, your prime minister has said this is no longer a refugee problem. It's a blatant attempt by Turkey to use desperate people to promote its geopolitical agenda and to divert attention from the horrible situation in Syria. But on the same time, you're hearing that in Moscow, there's been a joint press conference by President Putin and President Erdogan declaring a ceasefire. Do you think this will make a material difference? What hope do you have for a ceasefire if it goes into effect?
We acknowledge that Turkey has indeed a great burden concerning the crisis that has been escalated in Syria and elsewhere, and has indeed hosted a great number of immigrants and refugees. Having said that, we have to indicate that it is not coming directly only from Syria. It seems at the moment that a great percentage of immigrants and refugees in Turkey are coming from elsewhere. So indeed, we think that any possible help to Turkey would be, of course, a step to the good direction. On the other hand, we think that a ceasefire in Syria, in Idlib, would be definitely a good step. And we hope that this goes on. The Council of Foreign Ministers of the European Union are now gathered in Zagreb, and they're having the council today and tomorrow in order to decide how to assist this, the ceasefire and the diplomatization of the pressure and the crisis. We are very hopeful that things are going better in Syria, yet the truth is that the immigration problem is something that it should be treated independently of Syria, because now it's not only an immigration crisis. This has been upgraded to a different level. And of course, this level is now a real threat to the humanitarian values, because instrumentalizing people, irrespective of the principles stemming thereof, is something that goes against any source of human value. So,
okay.
Yes, we're hopeful about Syria. No, we cannot accept any source of manipulation of people.
And yet, of course, we're talking about human lives. We're talking about children who are dying because they're freezing to death in the cold. My colleague from the BBC, Jeremy Bowen, who's on the Greek-Turkey border, has tweeted pictures and the following. As you think about your bed or your children's, imagine being one of these kids, refugees from the wars of Syria and Iraq. They're without shelter, sleeping in the open tonight like thousands of others near Turkey's border with Greece. Their parents were close by, worried, sick. So, you know, you're Europe. You are trying, as your prime minister says, to defend Europe's external border. But these are human beings who have nowhere to go and nobody to lobby for them. We understand that the European Union has now pledged an extra $700 million or euros to Turkey for humanitarian reasons. What do you do when these desperate people come to you for help?
To tell you the truth, Christian, more than anyone else, it has been Greeks who have been really compassionate about this crisis and about this and about those children. In spite of the fact that we had an imminent and tremendous financial crisis in the last 10 years, it has been Greece that stood up and really, really supported all families coming to Greece, especially coming to the islands of Eastern Aegean. On the other hand, I have to say that it is not to the benefit of the families that we have this sort of massive circulation of people, because with those families, with those suffering, truly, genuinely suffering from war or from other mankind disasters, we also have a great number of people who are coming just to have an attack, a hybrid attack against the sovereignty of a state. I have to mention, Christian, that among the people who have been entering illegally in Greece, there have been people who were just get out of prison, just in order to be able to come to Greece. So, yes, we provide full assistance. And yesterday, I have to state this, yesterday the Council of Ministers of the European Union decided that there is going to be a wider protection for the unaccompanied children. As you probably know, it is only Greece at the moment who is protecting, to the extent possible, the unaccompanied minors. But the other European states have now expressed their respect to actually receive some of those children. But on the other hand, we have to discern those in true need from those who are here just to make troubles on the borders.
Minister, I just misspoke. I said that the EU had pledged 700 million euros to Turkey, but it's actually to you in Greece to continue being, as they say, human shields. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a pleasure and honor. Thank you, Christian.
Thank you so much. Now we look to the geopolitical challenges that created this crisis. In Afghanistan, after 18 years of war, a peace deal created on Saturday is already falling apart. Today, the Taliban launched more attacks on civilian and Afghan security forces. Simultaneously, we're seeing the fate of Syria play out, as we just discussed. Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan met in Moscow, and we do have this word of a ceasefire. Let's see whether it holds and how well. And let's get into it with the people who know best. Joining me from Washington is Vali Nasser, a former senior advisor to the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan. And from Indiana is the New Yorker columnist Susan Glasser. Welcome, both of you, to the program. Let's just quickly talk about, you know, about what we just heard from the state minister. You know, I sort of said it's deja vu all over again. We've talked about the humanitarian and the political fallout. But what do you think that this might do, Susan, in terms of, you know, upending politics again? It was the huge influx in 2015 that kind of led to the populist policies that we saw in Britain and then in America and across the European continent. How are you looking at this current influx?
Well, thank you, Christian. I agree that, you can't help but look at these horrifying pictures and see not only an unfolding humanitarian crisis, but also a sort of painful rerun and echo of that 2015 crisis that resounded so much in European and also, I think, in U.S. politics. One thing that strikes me from the vantage point of American politics right now in the presidential election is that President Trump, in some ways, is both a co-author, at least, of this, in the sense that the United States has made it very clear it no longer is interested in playing, to the extent it was, which was minimal to begin with, any kind of a real role in resolving the Syria crisis. And, of course, announcing earlier this year that the U.S. would back away from what presence it did have in Syria and handing that over, essentially, to Erdogan and Turkey, right? So on the one hand, you have the U.S. stepping out of even the possibility of playing a leadership role. On the other hand, a president who I would almost guarantee you will start to talk about this refugee crisis to say, look, that's why I want to close borders. That's why I'm in favor of, throwing up walls and not letting this kind of thing happen here in the United States. And, you know, again, the Europeans, they seem really at a loss, frankly. I was struck by that, how much there's not a strategic plan at all to deal with this, but once again, making the same mistakes of a few years ago.
And Vali, let's just quote something that President Erdogan said earlier about this. If European countries want to resolve the issue, they must support Turkey's efforts for political and humanitarian solutions in Syria. I mean, you know, Erdogan seems to turn the spigot on, turn the spigot off, depending on what he wants to achieve politically, militarily. What did you make of the state minister in Greece basically, you know, saying that this is a huge bit of leverage being used by Erdogan? How is this going to play out?
It's not playing out very well. I think President Erdogan has played a very risky game. First, he tried to get NATO to support Turkey against Russia in Syria. That didn't go very far. Then he tried to goad Europe into supporting Turkey against Russia and the Europeans balked. Now he's trying to essentially blackmail the Europeans. And that's now so transparent that it's going to damage Turkish-European relations in the long run. And he's not got very far with Putin either. He's arrived at a ceasefire, but Putin has not made any promises that he's going to give an inch to Erdogan in Idlib. And in a way, Erdogan has now sort of cornered himself. He's alienated Europe. He's not able to bring the United States into the fighting. He's not able to get very far from with Russia. And so in an act of desperation, he's putting a lot of pressure on Europe. And the European, for the first time, are balking at this. And it very well may end up creating a major humanitarian crisis on the border, for which Turkey will end up also assuming a good deal of the responsibility.
So what I found really interesting, and I don't know whether it jumped out at both of you, but when the state minister said only 4% of those at the border right now are from Syria. Others are from much further afield, like Afghanistan. And of course, Afghanistan is in the news a lot this week because almost a week after the U.S. signed a peace deal with the Taliban, things seem to be going downhill quite fast. So let me just get your reaction, because, Vali, you worked on this at the State Department, and you know Zalmay Khalilzad very well. He face-to-face had negotiations with the Taliban, something your previous boss, Richard Holbrooke, wanted to do. It never actually happened. Just walk us through the desire to get this peace deal and the mechanics of it so far.
So it's very clear that President Trump wants out of Afghanistan. And for the first time, the United States got very serious about a negotiated way to get out. And President Trump did something that President Obama couldn't and my boss, Richard Holbrooke, couldn't, which is to sit across the table from the Taliban and directly negotiate an exit package. The problem with President Trump's approach is that he never thought about a peace in Afghanistan. Essentially, he negotiated a withdrawal agreement for U.S. troops. So the Taliban would agree to certain things like not support terrorism, give U.S. troops safe passage, keep attacks at a minimum. And in exchange for that, the United States would leave Afghanistan. The Afghans themselves were never brought to the table. The Afghan government was never brought to the table. After the United States signed the deal, now it's asking the Afghan government to negotiate with the Taliban. And in fact, on behalf of the Afghan government, the United States promised that 5,000 Taliban prisoners would be released. Now, the Taliban have no incentive talking to the Afghan government because they think they've already signed the deal with the United States. And the Afghan government was never happy about the negotiations, argues that we were never even part of the negotiations. Why should we release these prisoners without getting some concessions from the Taliban? So the United States all of a sudden is finding itself in a situation that it never thought about the fact that it has to get the Afghans to talk with each other. And it now either has to just withdraw without a peace deal, which means Afghanistan returns to civil war, or it has to very quickly come up with a way to get the Taliban and the Afghan government to talk to each other. Otherwise, the Taliban will start escalating tensions and increase attacks. And the Afghan government's basically going to say, well, look, you negotiated this deal. It's yours. We weren't at the table. And we want basically serious concessions from the Taliban, and it's up to Washington to get the Taliban to deliver those.
I mean, to be fair, we'd been told that actually the Afghan government and the Taliban were meant to meet in Oslo. We don't know whether it's going to happen, but they were meant to very soon have face-to-face talks. Susan, extraordinarily, President Trump actually talked to a Taliban leader. And this is, you know, before two straight days of Taliban attacks on America, on Afghan forces, a U.S. counterattack, an airstrike on Taliban positions. But let me just play this soundbite by President Trump about his call.
I spoke to the leader of the Taliban today. We had a good conversation. We've agreed there's no violence. We don't want violence. We'll see what happens. They're dealing with Afghanistan, but we'll see what happens. Okay. We had actually a very good talk with the leader of the Taliban.
I don't know what you make of that. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary that the president of the United States would speak to the leader of the Taliban. I know he does things that are different. And, you know, he talked, obviously, face-to-face with Kim Jong-un. He wanted, if conditions had been right, to talk to the leader of Iran. How is this going to play out, this conversation that they both had?
Well, look, you know, Trump's personalization of foreign policy and often, you know, conflation of U.S. national interest with his own interest is one of the striking aspects of his presidency when it comes to dealing with the rest of the world. It's still amazing, right, in this place that we've been having U.S. troops at war for 19 years to have the president essentially saying he has a very good relationship, that was a phrase he used, with the head of the Taliban. Remember, he tried to actually invite Taliban leaders to Camp David to negotiate this deal right before the anniversary of 9/11 in September. He only backed off of that after an incident in which an American military personnel was killed. But, you know, you have Trump, who essentially has shown he's value neutral. He will talk with anybody if he thinks there's personal benefit to it. I think the challenge for American policymakers, right, is that they're constantly having to retrofit presidential pronouncements and make it look like it was part of a strategy or a plan or by design. That's why President Trump was more eager to meet with Kim Jong-un than he was able to negotiate a meaningful deal with the North Koreans. And I think that's the questions that are immediately being raised about this Afghan deal. Vali perhaps rightly characterized it as more of an exit agreement than a peace deal. Basically, it's saying the U.S. is getting out. But it is really notable that Trump has lavished more attention and praise, as you saw in that clip, on our adversaries, the Taliban, than on our erstwhile allies, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and his government, who were cut out entirely of the negotiations. There appear to be American commitments made around releasing 5,000 prisoners that the Afghan government does not want to live up to, understandably. And so you have a situation where Trump appears to be having a policy that is more willing to deal with adversaries than with allies, which is, I think, something we've seen across the board from him.
So I want to play to you. I mean, you talked about an exit deal, but I mean, part of this deal is basically to reduce American troops to zero. Within 4 months of a deal, 12,000 U.S. troops will become 8,600. And within 14 months, American and NATO troops will drop down to zero. Apparently, that's the parameters of this deal. And to be fair, this is a war that's been going on since 2001. I mean, everybody is sick of it. And it's just extraordinary that up until now, there hasn't been some kind of diplomacy that's been able to stop this war. But let me just ask you to play a little bit devil's advocate, because everybody looks at the current violence and say, oh, that means this Trump deal is not working. But here's what a senior military commander at the Pentagon said.
The Taliban is not a monolithic group. There's multiple terrorist organizations operating with it. So we don't know. I know the attack you're talking about. Got some initial reports on it. We don't know exactly who did that yet. That's the first point. Secondly, I would caution everybody to think that there's going to be an absolute cessation of violence in Afghanistan. That is probably not going to happen. It's probably not going to go to zero.
So, of course, that's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But he's basically speaking a truism. In all the peace negotiations that I've ever covered, there was always, you know, violence, even despite whatever you want to term, you know, a ceasefire, reduction of violence, et cetera, until the final I's and T's and all the rest of it were crossed. Vali, do you think that no matter how imperfect and how much it's being sort of, you know, messed around with at the moment, that there could actually be a deal out of this?
I'm not so much worried about breakdown of ceasefire at this point. I think the general is correct that there's going to be tensions going forward, and you're going to have some violence breaking up and some American attacks. I think the bigger problem is that the United States actually has no plans for how it's going to get the Afghan government and various other Afghan factions and the Taliban to arrive at a peace deal that would create a new constitution, perhaps a new government in Afghanistan, and would bring the Taliban in and bring at least a semblance of peace and order to Afghanistan. It all looks like an afterthought. So even on his call with the Taliban leader, President Trump never mentioned the importance of making a deal with the Afghan government. He never mentioned effectively that he looks forward to the Taliban sitting down at the table and negotiating with other Afghans. The problem is that, yes, we are tired of this war. But if the United States leaves without a deal, Afghanistan's going to go to civil war. Order is going to collapse. There's not going to be an Afghan government, which means that nobody's going to be there to actually fulfill the promises that President Trump thinks he got out of here, namely that no al-Qaeda will be allowed in Afghanistan. There's not going to be terrorism coming out of Afghanistan. And Afghanistan's neighbors are all extremely worried about what the U.S. is doing, because they think the U.S. is going to leave and Afghanistan is going to collapse into civil war and you're going to have refugees and violence that they then have to deal with. So I think the problem is that the president never really planned for a peace deal in Afghanistan. He really looked for a plan, as Susan put it, for an exit. And that the Taliban would give. And we might end up with that scenario where the U.S. cuts a deal with the Taliban, don't shoot at us, do these things, and we're going to go to zero, and then Afghanistan is on its own. And that could end up being a short-sighted victory, because we may not get anything out of this in the end.
I want to come back to that idea in a moment. But first, I want to move on to Israel, because, you know, these are several. We're talking about several issues that were high from the beginning on President Trump's agenda, drawing down U.S. forces all over the world, plus doing the deal of the century in Israel. So let's talk, Susan, about the possibility of the Trump-Bibi Netanyahu-Jared Kushner peace deal in light of this latest election. Netanyahu is claiming victory, but as yet we don't have a government or a coalition. What's going to happen, do you think? What do you see happening with this peace deal that most people say heavily favored Israel at the expense of the Palestinians?
Well, that's right, Christian. First of all, of course, it's really an extraordinary situation, a political gridlock in Israel. We're talking about three elections that have come up with very similar results, which is, a country divided, much as in the United States. Israel is basically at a hopeless impasse. Netanyahu has clung to power, but he's not been able to win a large enough mandate in these three elections to be able to easily form a new government under their parliamentary system. And now, by the way, he's under indictment and facing trial proceedings just a couple weeks after this third election. So some people were talking about a fourth election as a possibility. There's a possibility of Netanyahu, whose party did come out as the leader, to once again form a government. There's the possibility of a minority government being formed. So this is not an opportune moment yet to make any kind of deal, even if there were willing partners or something that people consider to be realistic on the table. Again, what you're seeing emerge, I think, across these themes with Afghanistan, with Israel, is the United States moving to a much more unilateralist point of view, a sort of our way or the highway type approach, even to international diplomacy. And, you need two sides, generally speaking, to make a peace, for there to actually be a peace. And so it's hard to see that what the United States proposed after years of work under Jared Kushner meets that test, in the same way that excluding the Afghan government from the peace negotiations makes it hard to see that as a deal in which the participants have all agreed to actually participate. So, I'm still very, very dubious that Israel is in any position to move forward. What you're more likely to see than a negotiated peace between Israel and the Palestinians at this point, of course, is more unilateral annexations on the part of Israel, or to preemptively declare some of the settlements in the West Bank to be parts of Israel. And certainly, if there were to be a second Trump term in the United States, along with Netanyahu continuing in power, I think that's the direction you would be likely to see things move in Israel. So away from possibility of a negotiated peace with the Palestinians.
And I guess finally, which is an extension of that is both Trump and Netanyahu, and of course the Gulf Arabs, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, etc., their joint, resolve against Iran. Vali, since President Trump's order to assassinate Qasem Soleimani, the top military commander, has Iran shown itself to be a paper tiger? How do you judge what's going on right now. We have, you know, this massive coronavirus. You've got the terrible sanctions in terms of how it's affecting civilians there, unable to get the medicine and the wherewithal that they need. And you've got, at the same time, the IAEA, the UN, now saying Iran is tripling its stockpile of uranium, enriched uranium. Just tell us how you see that situation playing out now.
Well, I think the assassination of Soleimani essentially led to a strategic pause by both sides. Iran did not react in a disproportionate manner. And the U.S. basically saw the killing as a sufficient deterrence against Iran. But it did not resolve issues because Iran is still sitting under tremendous sanctions. President Trump still wants to bring Iran to the table. And I would also see the IAEA report as a way in which Iran is escalating pressure again on the international community, except this time not through attacks in the Persian Gulf region, but rather through stockpiling more nuclear material. But the most important thing right now is the coronavirus. It has been a game changer within Iran. By some accounts, Iran's exports trade has fallen by 18%. Its non-oil exports have ground to zero because its borders are now closed. Its imports from China, consumer goods, machinery, intermediate goods have pretty much shut down. And domestic consumption, because of the quarantines and worry about the spread of the virus, has also declined. So Iran's economic position is far worse than when Soleimani was killed. And I think right now the country is obviously in the grip of this panic with the virus. But once it settles down, I think Iran is going to be in a very different place in terms of how much capacity it has to withstand okay. U.S. pressure. And it has to recalculate.
Yep. And we'll be watching with you, Vali Nasser and Susan Glasser. Thank you so much indeed for joining us this evening. And our next guest is a freshman Democratic lawmaker who, during a news conference in January, unexpectedly admitted that he battled with addiction. State Senator Peter Harkin hit rock bottom in the 1980s, but he sought treatment and now, after more than 30 years sober, is leading a bipartisan task force combating the worsening opioid crisis in New York. And he tells our Michelle Martin that he believes America has turned a major health issue into a crime.
You made quite an impression in your press conference at the Capitol in Albany. What made you decide to go public with your own personal story?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I just toured the state with our task force on opioids, addiction, overdose prevention, with my colleague, Senator Carlucci, Senator Rivera. And we wanted to find out what the gaps in the system were. And the number one barrier that we are still facing is stigma. And so if I was going to lead the charge on stigma, it was not fair of me to live with my own anonymity. So that's why I told my story.
How old were you when you started drinking?
Oh, probably 14, 15.
14?
Yeah.
How did that start? I mean, did you just bust into your parents' liquor cabinet or something
like
that?
Yeah, that's the way it started.
Did anybody notice?
No, it wasn't until college that it was really becoming apparent to folks that I might have an issue. And then in my early 20s, it was very apparent to people who knew me, to my family. So I eventually was able to get treatment when I was 27. And so it's been a while. But, you know, the pernicious thing about this disease is when you self-medicate, you build a tolerance and you need more. And then you build a tolerance for that and it stops working. And that's what leads to stronger substances.
I understand that it's been 3 decades since you, as you said, became sober. But I still think it would be helpful for people to know that a guy like you in a suit with the badge and the responsibility lived that. How did it work in your life? I mean, did you, like, go to school during the week and do all the things, and then on the weekends you would get drunk? Or, like, how is it that people didn't notice?
I think because people were so busy with their own lives. And when I was in high school, I still managed to hold things together. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in college, I was not a good student, you know, and I was not... I didn't have my priorities right, and that's when my drinking really took off in a heavy pace. And then I came back to New York, got involved in the advertising business. And that's when my downward spiral really started.
And
in
why
my
was
20s.
That? Because people drink a lot for the business and it was easy to hide? Or why you were under so much pressure that you were?
No, it wasn't pressure. It was that's what I needed to do. You know, that's physically what I needed to do to get by during the day. And it got to the point where when I wanted to stop, I couldn't stop. And so that last year was terrifying because I was in such pain. Self-medication wasn't working anymore. I had contemplated suicide, and I fortunately had a voice inside my head that said, you don't have to live this way anymore. And I picked up the phone and called somebody. And the next day I was on a train to Pennsylvania to go for treatment.
Was it just alcohol at that point, or had you brought
no,
other stuff
into
the mix?
No, it was everything. It was everything.
Yeah. Were you ever scared? Like, were you buying stuff off the black market?
That was the only way. You know, this was New York City in the 1980s. So it was a wild place in many ways.
A lot of people who had that experience, you know, their wake up call came because they got beat up or something. They're in the middle of a drug deal or something like that. That never happened to you.
No, you know, there were unpleasant experiences along the way, but and everyone has different sets of those. But, you know, it could be. What's relatable to everybody is the feelings and the despair and the disconnection from the human race and from other people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a disease of isolation. And so
we'll talk about that for a second. What do you mean by that? It's a disease of isolation.
Well, it's the inability to connect with people you love. It's the inability to connect with people in your life on an emotional level. You know, it's the old saying, if you could be in Madison Square Garden and feel all alone. And those are the kind of things, whether it's somebody, you know, who drinks white wine after they put their kids to bed or somebody who is living on a subway grate. You know, it's the similarity of the feelings that come about and the need to medicate those.
You've obviously had a distinguished career and you've got elected to, you know, you've built a successful business and you've been a successful professional and then you got yourself elected to office and now you're doing your thing. You could have kind of kept a secret. I mean, you could have just said, well, you know, that part of my life is over. That door is closed. I'm just going to kind of do my thing. Did you ever feel that way?
I felt when I was appointed to chair the Committee on Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, that for me, this was not just another committee assignment. It was a calling, and it happened for a reason. And I had a lot of assistance along the way. I had a lot of privilege in the sense that I had insurance. I had access to employment. I had access to transportation. I had access to medication. I had access to aftercare. A lot of those supports, a lot of people don't have to this day. And so it's up to me and people like me to raise our voice. And this was my one opportunity. It's not just me. There are other colleagues in the Senate, in the Assembly who are dedicated to this issue, to increasing funding, to passing laws that break the barriers. Because when, you know, 3,700 people in 1 year dying in New York, that's more than died on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And as horrible a tragedy as that was, it mobilized us as a nation. It mobilized us as a state. But when 3,700 people die because of an opioid overdose, we don't mobilize that way because of the stigma. You know, they're a silent voice. You know, who wants a harm reduction program in their neighborhood? Who wants sober housing in their neighborhood? Who wants a rehab in their neighborhood? You know, do you want your tax dollars to go to a beautiful new park, or do we want to increase the salaries of the people who are providing treatment so we can attract and recruit and retain qualified, competent people?
You ever think about some of the people who are locked up and think, gee, you know, what's the difference between them and me?
I think about them all the time, and there is no difference between them and me. You know, and unfortunately, because of the color of my skin, that may have played a part of that. But we have criminalized a health issue. You know, alcoholism, addiction, substance use disorder, it's a disease. And we have locked up thousands and thousands and thousands of people for having a disease. And that's part of the stigma, you know, that it's illegal, it's a crime, you know, but we don't lock diabetics up when a diabetic needs their medicine. So we've got to change the narrative that we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We're not going to demonize our way out of this problem. This is a health issue, and we need to mobilize our public health apparatus to address it.
Do you think that part of the reason there has not been this perspective that it's a public health crisis is that a lot of the people who've been caught up in the criminal justice aspect of it are not the same color as you? You think that's part of it?
I think it is. And in fact, you know, my colleagues who represent urban districts bristle, and rightfully so, because this issue did not necessarily get the attention it should have, you know, until white people in the suburbs started dying, you know, and black and brown folks were dying at a high rate for a long time in a lot of neighborhoods, and they weren't getting the resources they needed to address it then.
Can I ask you this? Because you're obviously a very well-educated man. Where were you when all that was going on? I mean, where were you when the war on drugs was locking up all these kids in these neighborhoods for doing the same stuff that you were doing? But, you know, did it ever occur to you then to get involved and to go public?
You know what? I used to volunteer in a prison in Northern Westchester, Women's Prison, did a substance abuse group then. But I was not as educated to these issues then. I was not as socially aware back then. I started to become aware when I was a county legislator in Westchester and spent a fair amount of time working in the county correctional facility and seeing and hearing the stories of how many people were there because of untreated mental illness and substance use disorder. And so that's when I started to become educated and then to really, really hear the impacts. You know, really my education furthered when I became a senator.
What's it been like for you at the legislature since you went public with your own life? I know that you said that your own history. I know that you said that you'd never hidden it and the people closest to you certainly knew about it. But I mean, goodness gracious, your story in the New York Times, that it went viral. I mean, what's it been like for you?
Just another day at the office.
Really? Okay. Because that just happens all the time. You become a national figure overnight. Sure.
No, I mean, people said, nice job. And then, you know, we're back to work on the budget, you know, because I told the story not for it to be about me. You know, I want to focus attention on the issue. And if telling my story helps to begin the dialogue and breaking down the stigma, you know, was happy to do it. But there's still a lot of hard work to be done. That was not the end of anything. That was, if anything, that was just a conversation opener about the scope and the magnitude of the problem.
What is it that you most want people to understand that you think a lot of people don't?
I think first and foremost that this is a public health issue, that we're talking about a disease. We're not talking about a moral failing. We're not talking about a crime. We're talking about a disease. And so, A, it's okay for people to ask for help. It's okay for families to reach out to ask for help. And it's something that we need to devote a lot more resources to. You know, we see harm reduction works. We dedicate precious few resources to needle exchange. We don't have safe consumption centers in the United States. We visited one in Toronto. All across Canada, they have them. They've had no fatalities. So our first goal has got to be, if we're talking about people being sick, then let's save them. Let's meet them where they are. So the first thing is keep people alive, because not everybody's ready for treatment. So let's meet people where they are. Let's keep them alive. And then you have a chance to slowly bring them in. And then there are other people who are ready for treatment. We have to get a bed to immediately. And then there are other people who are at risk. They may be abstinent for a while, but if they're coming out of prison, They still have the disease. They still have the co-occurring malady that caused them to self-medicate in the first place. They pick up to use the same amount, but their tolerance is gone. So that's one of the largest groups of folks who die of overdose are people coming out of the correctional facility.
You know, it's interesting. When you raise these issues in a lot of communities, I mean, people have lost their careers over this. I mean, the former mayor of Baltimore, Kurt Schmoke, he's now a very, you know, distinguished university head. He's certainly gone on to contribute in a number of other ways. His political career was basically ended because he advocated decriminalizing marijuana, like, 20-some years ago. I mean, even more recently, the former attorney general of the United States, Jeff Sessions, who was President Trump's first attorney general, with whom he obviously had a falling out, you know, there were people in the department who talked about this, and they were laughed out of the room. They were ridiculed out of the room. Yeah. And so I'm just wondering, like, what makes you think that people are actually willing to entertain these ideas?
I'm at the point in my life where I want to do the right thing, not necessarily the electable thing. You know, in my district, it probably would have been much safer not to support legalizing marijuana in New York State. And after a year and some good changes that Senator Krueger made to her bill to address some of the issues raised by my constituents, I endorsed her proposal. It would have been a lot safer for me not to make that statement. It would have been safer for me not to vote for driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. You know, I could point to a lot of votes that we've done in the last year, and it would have been a lot safer for me not to if I was looking at my next election. You know, but my focus is to do the right thing today.
There's been a debate, decriminalization versus legalization. I mean, some people think that decriminalizing marijuana use is a good middle ground between people who are afraid that that which you permit, you promote, right? And so some people still see marijuana as a gateway to other things. And they say, you know, why not decriminalize it, but don't legalize it, because thereby you're not really giving society's imprimatur to it. What about that argument?
And that's, I hear that a lot, is that legalizing is de facto promotion. And we're not promoting because the marketplace has spoken. There are adults widely using marijuana. So why don't we tax this, regulate the product, and put the money to a social good? And in the Senate bill, 25% of the money from the tax revenue goes to treatment, prevention, and education, which is desperately needed infusion of cash into the community mental health system, substance use disorder, and harm reduction systems. So why don't we put that money to a social good? People are using the product anyhow. But certainly let's regulate it and take all the impurities out of it. So we're protecting health to that degree. But, you know, quite honestly, there's not a high school in New York State where you can't buy marijuana. And so we're not promoting marijuana. Marijuana is not a gateway drug. The science is clear on that. But the marketplace has spoken, so let's tax it.
Governor Cuomo has said he wants this to be the year that marijuana is legalized in New York State. Do you think that that's going to happen? And what makes you think, whatever it is, your opinion is?
You know, I don't know. It's an election year. And so everybody is going to take a different approach on this. Obviously, there are a number of people who are supporting it. I am in support of the Senate bill, which is a slightly different version than the governor's bill. So it really comes down to two factors. One, can we reconcile the differences with the Senate bill, with the governor's bill? And also, where do people stand politically? This is an election year. But you know, after hearing and documenting the gaps in the system we have, you know, I can't walk away from a potential revenue source for the treatment and community mental health networks.
Senator Peter Harkin, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
Really interesting conversation there between Michelle and the senator. And we just want to mark the fact that the last major female candidate for president has now dropped out of the 2020 race. Senator Elizabeth Warren left her supporters with this last thought.
And I wonder what your message would be to the women and girls who feel like we're left with two white men to decide between.
I know. One of the hardest parts of this is all those pinky promises and all those little girls who are going to have to wait 4 more years. That's going to be hard.
And finally, we want to pay tribute to another extraordinary woman, Rosalind P. Walter, who's died at the age of 95. During World War II, she joined the Army of Women supporting the troops. She worked the night shift helping to build fighter planes, which was a man's job back then before they went off to war. And she became the original cultural icon, Rosie the Riveter. Rosalind P. Walter later became a major philanthropist and the most generous supporter of PBS television and indeed of this program. And we owe her a debt of gratitude. That's it for now from us. You can always catch us online, on our podcast and across social media. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.